Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with Drs. Hugo Skornick and Benjamin Summers about healthcare reform and immigration. This should be it's a timely and important topic, and thinking about how immigration plays a role into the complexity of our healthcare reform challenge, I think is going to be important for us to talk about.
Yeah, these two authors had some really interesting perspectives in the New England Journal of Medicine. We're really happy to bring them to Your Health listeners across the region and the country. But first, Christy, we have some really interesting research that matters today about a variety of topics.
We'll talk about meditation and whether it lowers blood pressure.
About different ways of understanding remarriage, and is it good for the people who get remarried in some ways?
And about walking tied to breast cancer in older women and preventing.
And then finally, if you've had a melanoma, do you stay out of the sun like the doctors recommend or not? Well, let's dive right in, Chris. You're our first research that matters about meditation and blood pressure, because I was surprised by these findings.
I was surprised too. So we've linked stress reduction exercises to many health benefits over the years, and I think the thinking is that it should lower one's blood pressure. But this was a study that was looking at 8 weeks of mindfulness meditation to see if it had an effect on people who had mildly elevated blood pressure.
This research that was published in the American Journal of Hypertension took participants that were ages 20 to 75 and all had kind of high normal blood pressure, and they all got the standard advice to eat less salt, quit smoking, and exercise more. And they got really a pretty extensive 8 weekly group sessions and a day-long silent retreat, which I found interesting. And then they were asked to practice stress reduction for 45 minutes a day, and then they were followed to find out, did this lower their blood pressure?
And the bottom line is this 8 weeks of mindfulness meditation had no effect on these people who had slightly elevated blood pressures and not taking medication compared with their counterparts who were not doing the mindfulness meditation.
And this does not mean that these participants didn't get benefits, and doesn't mean that our listeners wouldn't certainly get benefits from doing mindfulness-based stress reduction. As a matter of fact, some previous research has shown that Zen Buddhist meditation, and I think it's called Zhejiang, you can correct me if that's not right, significantly reduced blood pressure, but not this particular form of mindfulness meditation, according to this study.
I think that this is the beginning of us understanding the relationship. And while I wouldn't tell you to go out and do meditation alone, if your doctor recommends medication or a broader approach to your blood pressure, then you should do that. But meditation might be a piece of it. But at least according to this study, not a difference for this reason.
And medication, in addition to salt and obesity, is still probably the strongest way of reducing one's blood pressure.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about our very next research that matters that has to do with people who get remarried and the complexity, not with necessarily the remarriage, but the complexity of caring for, as you get older, a partner in a remarriage who might have Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia.
So that complex situation is common. Approximately a third of all American marriages are remarriages for at least one partner. And then you've got nearly 5% of our population, which is more than 15 million Americans, who are caring for someone who has dementia.
So those two things combined, there's going to be a lot of overlap in caring for elderly family members in a second marriage. And this particular research in the Journal of Marriage and Family looks at, well, how difficult is this, and are there some things that we should be aware of?
So research done at the University of Michigan, they recruited 61 remarried wife caregivers from across the country. So women who were remarried and were caring for their husband with dementia. The average length of the women's current marriages was about 17 years. And what they did was they had them diagram their social networks and put people and things into either a social network, positive network, or a negative network to sort of define their support system.
And what they found is that while the stepchildren were at least half the time a step family member was in the positive network, 35% of the time stepchildren were in what was considered by the wives as a negative group related to caretaking. And this usually related to things like caring for the spouse with care-related decisions, giving advice, subjective opinions about interference or criticizing end-of-life issues, inheritance issues, very complex and things that I hadn't really fully thought about.
Well, it really highlights, and, you know, in family medicine, we look at the social structure and the impact of the family structure on a person's health. And in this case, you can really see how that plays out when there's complicated family dynamics. It really plays out when you're having to make tough decisions. So I think this really highlights for us as Americans that we should be having these conversations in advance. We should be raising these issues when we're healthy and able to make decisions and trying to smooth out those relationships and make it clear what your wishes are.
And I think it's not just with the step family. I think there's also lots of plenty.
We see it all the time, don't we?
In our own families and immediate families. And so I think that advice for opening up these lines of considerations around care-related issues, around money, inheritance, medical decisions, let's open up the door for anyone in the families because these are important issues that we all have to deal with.
Absolutely. Let's jump into our next one, walking into our next one, which is about walking and exercise being linked to having fewer breast cancers in older women.
This is research that was published by the American Association for Cancer Research based on data from researchers at the American Cancer Society that looked at over 74,000 women between the ages of 50 and 74 and surveyed them at three different times, 1999, 2001, and 2005, to see if regular exercise could prevent breast cancer, a really important topic.
And they found that the women who walked at a moderate pace for at least 7 hours each week, back when they were taking the studies in 1992, were 14% less likely to be diagnosed with breast cancer compared with those people who walked for 3 hours or less each week.
And if they exercised even more vigorously than 7 hours a week, they had a 25% reduction less likely to be diagnosed with breast cancer. And this translates into what I think is an important health benefit, and to me, one of the more exciting pieces of research that matters, that this is something that a lot of women, not every woman, but a lot can do to reduce their risk of breast cancer.
It can't prove that walking prevented the cancer, but there is a relationship there. And it makes sense that walking and exercise can affect your hormones, which can affect the cancer. And so it's just, to me, another reason why physical fitness and activity can be a good thing for your health.
Let's talk about our last research that matters. This is a very concerning research that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Dermatology Journal about people being diagnosed with melanoma, and then what happens with them 2 to 3 years after their diagnosis. Do they reduce their sun exposure? Because that's a huge risk factor in recurrent melanomas.
Well, you know, this is near and dear to me. My father died in his 40s from melanoma. A really good friend and coworker has had melanoma. We were just having this conversation, just like the people in the study. After her melanoma, she backed off on the sun for a year or two, but then she's picked right back up and is getting sunburns and continuing to sunbathe.
And that's what happened here. Mm-hmm. 20 women and men with melanoma, and the first year they cut down, the next 2 years they kind of went back. And what was even shocking is in the third year after their diagnosis, almost a little over more than half of these people diagnosed with melanoma actually got a sunburn. And it's like, oh my goodness. So bottom line here, if you have melanoma, if your loved ones have melanoma, you really need to follow your dermatologist and your primary care provider's advice about eliminating most sun exposure.
We are going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Drs. Hugo Skornick and Benjamin Summers about healthcare reform and immigration. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Hugo Skornick and Dr. Benjamin Summers, physicians who just wrote really important articles in the New England Journal of Medicine, the same issue about the same topic, health and immigration reform, very important perspectives on access to health care. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Skornick and Dr. Summers.
And Dr. Skornick, you are a pediatrician in Georgia, and Dr. Summers, a general internist in a community health center in Boston and also involved in policy research. We are delighted to have you with us. Wonder, perhaps, Dr. Summers, if you might be willing to frame some of this topic for us and so our listeners can understand how significant of a problem it is for undocumented immigrants to receive health care.
Chris, it's a really important question to kind of lay the groundwork. Most undocumented immigrants in the U.S., and depending on the estimate, there are about 10 million living in the U.S. currently, don't have access to the kinds of health insurance that the rest of the country has. The options of getting coverage through employers is generally not available in the kinds of jobs that most of these immigrants have, and they generally are premiums or beyond what they can afford. And the government programs such as Medicare and Medicaid are not available by law to undocumented immigrants. And so this leaves the vast majority of them with really no way of having health insurance, and then making it significantly more difficult for them to afford the health care that they need.
And so what options do they have to receive health care?
So as with anyone else in the U.S. who doesn't have health insurance, there are some places where there's a care that is available either at a discounted price or through a charity center. This includes safety net hospitals and community health centers, which are committed to providing care for people regardless of their immigration status and their ability to pay. But there is far more demand than supply available for this. And that means that a lot of undocumented immigrants who lack health insurance are often left paying out-of-pocket bills they can't afford, hoping they don't get sick, and if they do, ending up in the emergency room or admitted to hospitals and left with thousands of dollars in debt that they're unlikely to be able to ever pay.
You know, Dr. Skornick, in your essay in the New England Journal of Medicine, it reminds me of what we call a case control study sometimes, which is you don't need a lot of long research to sometimes make such an important point. And your essay is not long, but you really just bring some poignant vignettes about some of your patients that are undocumented immigrants. Tell us a story about how what Dr. Summers just mentioned comes to life in your pediatric practice.
Well, thank you, Adam, and thank you for having me. Let me just say that I'm a general pediatrician. I've been here in Conyers, Georgia for 16 years, and I speak Spanish. And I've attracted over the years a number of Hispanic patients just gradually over time, and now about half my practice is seeing Hispanic patients, with a good portion of them being undocumented immigrants. And so over the years, I've just seen a lot of these issues come to light, like you said, not regarding the research, but for example, during my essay that I submitted, I briefly describe a family of undocumented immigrants who came to see me because the dad had end-stage liver disease, and the family had no health care options left in the United States. They came to see me with their child asking for advice, but there was really no advice to give. He had, like I said, end-stage liver disease. It was really sad. They ended up, the dad decided to return to Mexico for palliative care by himself, and he left behind his wife and his children.
He couldn't have gone to the hospital and gotten emergency care?
He, um, he was admitted to the hospital here for a week, and that's where they diagnosed him with that he had hepatitis C, and that's where he was diagnosed. I'm not an internist, so you may know more than I do, but my understanding was that there really wasn't a lot to do for him. But for example, if they wanted to do treatment for his esophageal varices that he had, that was an outpatient procedure, and no one around here would be willing to do that.
Hmm. Yeah.
So his only option was to go return to his country separate from his family, where he likely passed away apart from his loved ones.
That's correct. And that's not the only thing that I see. I've seen people who've had to go to Mexico just for routine surgeries, of course. And then, you know, there's a whole host of other issues besides the healthcare issues that I see every day here. These patients live in poverty with no social safety net supporting them. Many of them here live in trailer parks. They can't drive legally in Georgia. I know that's different in different states, but that's a huge burden here. They have to take a taxi just to come see me. And if I have to send them to Atlanta for specialty care, it becomes very pricey for them to go.
Hmm. No, I was going to just ask Dr. Summers. You mentioned in your essay that 80% of adult undocumented immigrants are in the labor force. And it seems to me then that this is perhaps one of the paradoxes of immigrant status. How does the fact that they're in the employment system, but yet they're seemingly outside of the healthcare system, how does that paradox really unfold?
You know, the majority of Americans still do get their health insurance through their employers, but it's a steadily declining share that does that, and it really depends a great deal on the type of job and the socioeconomic status of the worker. So high-paying jobs for people with college degrees in large firms almost always provide health insurance. And at the other end of the spectrum, when you start looking at small companies and you look at lower-wage workers, and in particular, people in the kinds of industries that the majority of undocumented immigrants work in, including things like service professions, child care, house cleaning, landscaping, agriculture, these fields have very low rates of companies offering health insurance. And so what you end up with is, even though the majority of these households have at least one member who's working, they almost never have the availability of health insurance through that job. And because they're excluded from Medicaid and Medicare, it really becomes a state-by-state decision as to whether they're going to have any health insurance. And in most cases, the answer is they won't, leaving them in the position that Dr. Skornik is describing. And one of the nuances that I think he raises really, really beautifully in his essay is in describing the fact that while this father doesn't have any access to insurance, his child was born in the United States and is a U.S. citizen. And so what we actually have here is, while I think a lot of opponents of immigration reform would like to have us think that there's a group of they're immigrants and then they're U.S. citizens and there's no overlap. And the truth is that a lot of these families have both people. You have parents who were born overseas and are either here as legal or undocumented immigrants, and their children who are born here are U.S. citizens. So we've set up a system where the children might be eligible for a program, but their parents aren't, or one sibling who's younger might be and the older one isn't. So we've really made life incredibly difficult for these families to get the care that even the citizens in the household, these children who were born and entitled to all of our health services in our system, that they can't get what they need because their parents can't, you know, access insurance, they can't drive, and they have other barriers to their kind of accessing the services of the whole family.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we come back, I would like to pick up on this conversation we have about some of the real challenges at the practice level of providing care and some of the ideas that you have for some solutions. We're talking with Dr. Benjamin Summers and Dr. Hugo Skornik about the recent articles in the New England Journal of Medicine about immigration and healthcare and reform. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We have been talking with Dr. Hugo Skornick and Dr. Benjamin Summers about healthcare and immigration reform. And before the break, you both were laying out the complexity of the issue of undocumented citizens in our country not able to receive healthcare. And I know that Dr. Skornick, as a pediatrician in Georgia, you have been taking care of patients for many, many years. And wonder, from your clinical wisdom from all these years, what you have to glean and what message you have to providers and medical professionals and ultimately to our legislators about the challenges and unique needs of undocumented patients.
Well, Christy, that's a difficult question to answer. I think the first thing that I would like to say is my overall experience, I've been working here for 16 years, is that the undocumented immigrants that I see, they're good people. They're people just like anybody else who I feel like they stay in the country, you know, for their children. Their children a lot of times have full access to, like we were talking about, full access to all the rights of being American if they were born here. And they have to put up with a lot just to stay here. And I don't know. It's just not right when we look at them in the eye, and you know, you see someone with severe disease that can't get health care. You see them not being able to drive. You see them being victims of crime, but being scared to report it because they're scared to expose themselves to the law. Working in under the table jobs in harsh conditions. It's just a tough thing to see every day. And I don't know. I just have empathy for that.
Well, and I think that's one of the messages, and clearly it's something that you offer to your patients that's a critical piece of things. And I think, Dr. Summers, you raise a paradox that I think makes perhaps providing this empathy even more difficult, which is that under the Affordable Care Act, you write in your article that public support for programs that treat uninsured patients may actually decrease. How will that work? And then how do you think providers and policymakers should respond?
So the Affordable Care Act is really designed to expand the pathways to affordable health insurance for, you know, tens of millions of currently uninsured people living in the U.S. But it explicitly excludes undocumented immigrants from either the expanded eligibility for Medicaid or the tax credits that will help people purchase insurance through the health insurance marketplace. So while it will do a lot for health insurance options among legal immigrants who experience high rates of lacking health insurance, for undocumented immigrants, they're shut out of those options. And so when you look at what's left for them, they still will continue to have some availability of care through community health centers, and there is increased funding in the Affordable Care Act for health centers. So that can provide some benefit for this population. But the flip side of it is that the law took an aggressive approach to trying to cover the costs of expanded coverage. And so the policymakers who wrote this law looked to figure out, well, where can we kind of shift dollars around to keep the budget impact stable? And so, for instance, there's funding that goes through Medicaid and Medicare to safety net hospitals called disproportionate share or DSH payments. And basically the idea was, well, if more people have health insurance, then we'll need less of the safety net payment to hospitals. So the law scales that money back and instead puts it into Medicaid and these tax credits. And the problem is that while in general coverage will be expanded, as I said earlier, it's not expanded in this population for undocumented immigrants. And so what happens is they have no new coverage options, And at the same time, some of the money that was set aside to help safety net providers care for uninsured patients like them is being scaled back. So while the overall policy approach makes sense, the group that's kind of caught in the crosshairs are those immigrants who have no new health insurance options and may, in fact, have less money coming into the safety net to the providers that care for them.
And outline for us the options for path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants and the limitations that exist under the Affordable Care Act.
So the Affordable Care Act really doesn't do anything to change the status of undocumented immigrants. And, you know, at the same time that we are implementing health reform, we are now kind of about a year into a serious debate about immigration reform. And the pathway that has been outlined in the proposal that was developed in the Senate would create an opportunity for undocumented immigrants to ultimately become U.S. citizens, but that pathway is actually quite long and would take well over a decade before there was the possibility of becoming a U.S. citizen and therefore eligible for Medicaid or tax credits or the like. So you know, there's a great deal of uncertainty of whether that bill will even pass. Given everything we've seen in Washington the last several months, it's quite unlikely, I think, that any major immigration overhaul is going to be able to get enough support to be signed into law. But even if that reform does get passed, the truth is we're still a decade away or more from undocumented immigrants who are currently in the U.S. having that pathway to get Medicaid or get tax credits to buy health insurance. So the paradox there is that we finally have national health reform. We may end up with fundamental immigration reform, but for a decade or more, we're still stuck in a situation where most undocumented immigrants don't have a way to pay for their care.
And, you know, with that challenge and the empathy that Dr. Skornick really displays and both of you display, I want to maybe just return to our final kind of question, which I was struck when I was reading your essay, Dr. Skornick, that you talked about that you are bilingual. And while we have a training program here for many of our residents to become bilingual by the time they graduate, that says something about your commitment. But I understand it wasn't always that case. How did you become bilingual? Because you're providing both access to care, but also compassionate care and culturally competent care.
My parents were born in Argentina. So I emigrated from Argentina when I was 2 years old. So Spanish was actually my first language. So I never thought that was an important part of my life when I was growing up. I didn't know anyone else who spoke Spanish. And and when I applied for this job right out of residency, I didn't even put it on my application that I spoke Spanish. It was not the perfect Spanish. And now look at me. I'm, you know, most of my patients speak Spanish, and my Spanish has improved tremendously. My patients speak it, and of course it's crucial in taking care of these patients. Just like anyone, they would, you know, prefer someone who could speak the language. Many of the Hispanic patients, in the next generation, their English, of course, is perfect. So the language barrier should fall away with, I would say, 10 more years. There'll be a lot less issues with the language.
Well, we want to thank Dr. Hugo Skornick and Dr. Benjamin Summers for sharing your language of health policy considerations around immigration reform and update and the compassionate, empathetic, and culturally competent care that you both provide as role models for all of us. Thank you for joining us on Your Health Today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Check out our comprehensive community calendar, photo galleries, and all of our news stories and more from 97.9 FM WCHL on chapelboro.com.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
Please send any comments you have, any stories, any experiences with healthcare, any questions to yourhealth@unc.edu, and we'll read them on an upcoming show.
And now we'll have our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, read us some very great house call questions about smelly feet and teething and all kinds of things.
Including wax in the ears. That's a common problem.
Erica, give us our very first house call question.
My bouncing baby boy is 7 months old and a few teeth are coming in. My husband and I are trying to make him comfortable as possible, but it's not easy. Between our little guy screaming in agony, us not being able to find a toy in the world to distract him from the pain, and the dog barking whenever he hears the baby crying, I'm about to have a breakdown. I'm looking into homeopathic remedies. What do you guys have to say about them?
Well, there are a lot of questions within this, and I'll tell you, our heart goes out to you. Thank you for sharing your question with us. And it sounds like you got a lot of things going on with the teething and the dog barking and
thinking. And that baby boy bouncing all over the place. I just kind of look at it like, you know, like a basketball. It's just bouncing and around and very active.
Yes.
It's great, though.
And the teething period can be particularly troublesome. If he's screaming that much, it makes me wonder, is it teething? And should there you get him checked out to see if maybe he's got a ear infection or something else going on? But for teething itself, there are a lot of things you can do to try to soothe the pain.
Yeah, one of my favorite ones, which is pretty simple, is if you can actually take a little bit of ice and put it on your fingers and get your fingers cold and then just rub a cold finger along the gum lines. Mm-hmm. Cold is a really good anesthetic and it's inexpensive. Don't know of any side effects.
Let him chew on your finger or chewing on a cold washcloth. If you make it wet and stick it in the freezer, that can be something. There are all kinds of teething toys that have the where you can freeze them and let him kind of gnaw and chew on those to get cold in his mouth.
You ever refrigerate a pacifier? You ever do that? That's another way you can do.
I have done it before. It didn't last for very long. But those are some ideas. Homeopathic remedies, I think I would want to know exactly what you're thinking about doing. Homeopathic can mean different things to different people. But if you're talking about giving those little dilutions of what people would consider toxins in tiny, tiny amounts, there's definitely no evidence to say that that works. And so we wouldn't recommend that at this point.
We know that there's a very strong proponents of those out in the community and that many people will swear by it. But we, again, it's not something that we would recommend. We would recommend that you certainly at times can use some drops of acetaminophen sometimes if need be. And again, even some cold food, if the child is eating food already, you can actually, the cold food and lightly frozen can just, again,
like
be very numbing. Yeah, exactly.
We wish you all the best and hope that between the dog and the teething and all of these things that it settles down a little bit for you and you're able to get some sleep.
Let's listen to our very next house call, Erica.
So the all-time worst feeling for me is to feel wax in my ear. I hate the wet sensation that I have, and I admit Q-tips are my best friend. I despise earwax so much that I usually use Q-tips about 3 times a day. Yes, I know this may sound like an OCD problem, and it very well could be, but it's what I do. After listening to your show a few weeks ago about stem cell implants, I got worried that I may be harming my ears. I know that Q-tips are discouraged, but I continue to use them. What do you guys think?
Well, first off, we should say what OCD is. You certainly know about it. Obsessive compulsive disorder. And could you have OCD using Q-tips like that?
Three.
Maybe, but you certainly are in tune with yourself. And let's see what Christy has to say.
Yeah, 3 times a day is a lot. so it sounds like if Q-tips are your best friend and that and the feeling of wax in your ear is the worst thing ever to you, then you have to weigh out the benefit of that feeling and how much you love them and the risks. And really, the risks with wax and putting Q-tips in your ear are two things that come to my mind. One is that you could poke it in so far and, you know, rupture your eardrum, which hurts. And the other is that you pack the wax into your ear, which then makes it you have hard time hearing and harder to get out. It's not irreparable. You can get the wax out, but not with a Q-tip when you pack it in your ear like that.
I'm kind of thinking, Christy, what my grandmother would have said to me if I asked her about could I put a Q-tip in my ear three times a day.
You started talking country just when you started talking about your grandmother.
Well, yeah, because, well, she's from Boston and New York. Is that country enough? She would have said, nothing good can come from this. And I think that really putting a Q-tip in your ear three times a day, there's not a whole lot of good that can come from that. That's enough of a habit that I would suggest perhaps a different best friend could be in order here. Because ultimately, the sensation itself may be what you're looking for. And that sensation, enough stimulation of that, I think could cause some skin irritation and problems for you.
Yeah, you may be causing that feeling in your ear of wet and problems because you're kind of irritating the skin there. That's a good point, Adam. Well, we wish you all the best and think that you might, next time you feel that feeling, just go check it out with your doctor and see if there's actually wax in your ear. And try to come up with a better plan.
Ask your grandmother.
Let's take our next house call question, Erica.
My husband has the worst smelling feet on the planet. It's not a sweaty smell. I could live with that. It's more of a sour smell that will just make you nauseous. I've done everything to try and improve the smell. I've sprinkled his shoes with scented powder, left deodorizer pads in his shoes, sprayed his feet with perfume, and even made him apply scented lotion. And it's not like he has bad hygiene. He takes 2 showers a day. Could this be some type of medical problem that's causing the smell?
I just smile as I hear your question. I should be frowning thinking about the smell. But all I can think about is my sister's picking on me for smelly feet or songs that my kids sing, trick or treat, smell my feet.
And I'm just feeling sorry for your husband a little bit.
Poor
I mean, here, the poor thing here, he's like, you know, you're the culprit here for stinking up the car. And I think your question, though, is a great question, which is there a medical condition? And the short answer is yes. I think several years ago, Christy, we talked about a condition of the feet and sometimes the hands called pitted keratolysis. And we'll ask our health science librarians to put up a link of this on our website. But it's a condition of excess bacteria causing excessive production of chemicals that are really obnoxious and noxious to smell.
And the good news is that if this is the case, there are antibiotics that he could take that might just clear it up for him. And then you could both feel happy for no more smelly feet.
You might have to go see your primary care physician and or a dermatologist, someone who specializes in really looking and understanding what this can be and doesn't just tell you, oh, put an antiperspirant on it.
And we'll have our very last house call question.
I have these random bouts of nausea. It happens a few times a week, and it's beginning to make me a little nervous. It happens at work and at home and at various times of the day, so I can't pinpoint exactly what's causing it. I'm young and healthy, I eat right, and I usually try to get plenty of exercise. I don't smoke, and I only drink on occasion. And since I'm male, I know I can't be pregnant. What are your thoughts?
Well, you thought of a lot of things that came to my mind initially. A couple things that come to mind are H. pylori, a bacteria that can cause stomach ulcers. You could have some inflammation or gastritis in your stomach. Sometimes this could be a presentation of having heart pain that presents with nausea. So I'd want to know if it happens when you exercise.
And unfortunately, sometimes I ask simple questions like, are you taking aspirin or Advil or Metaprin or Nuprin or BC powders, any of those? And the answer is, well, yeah, I take those on a regular basis. And so my first thing is stop those.
Yeah, we wish you all the best and encourage you to go and get that checked out if you're continuing to have this ongoing nausea. We thank you for your questions. We want those of our listeners out there to send us your questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at Your Health Radio or on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app.
We'd like to thank UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guests today, Dr. Hugo Skornick and Dr. Benjamin Summers. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to talking with you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.